Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, I thought we'd talk about the spiritual life of animals, including pets. Now, you might say, well, that's an interesting show. Any reason for doing that? Yeah, we actually have a new member of a group of people who are doing spiritual work. And that member is a new little puppy. Yeah, and it's a Havanese dog. I'm not sure if that is the correct pronunciation, but I'm thinking it's Havanese. And so it originates from Cuba, and so it has a little Spanish type of background. And I don't think the dog speaks Spanish. If it did, I wouldn't know, because I'm not really that successful at speaking Spanish. I did try taking a course on it, but at any rate, so this kind of encouraged me to talk tonight about the spiritual life of animals, including pets, and to talk about all kinds of things that may be relevant. Most people don't know about this, and they have animals that live with them, or some people eat them, of course, and then other things. And so I think all of this kind of is a big subject, because we live in a world in which animals are really a major part of our world. And for some folks, it's important because if they have pets, they have new pets, and then they have old pets, and then some of the older pets may die, and they want to know what's going to happen to them. And these are kind of important issues. And a lot of people don't know what role animals play in the scheme of life. And I think this is an important part, too. So we can kind of go into that. For those of you who have any curiosity of what I said about the new little fellow who came to be with us, his name is, officially, I guess, tonight, his name is Neo. He kind of picked it out himself about a bunch of different names we tried, including Lassie. I tried every name in the book to see what he liked. And that was the only name he actually really seemed responsive to. So, yeah, okay, he's a Cuban dog. Neo happens to be a Cuban language name. I know it's in part of a fairly famous movie, and a lead character was named Neo in that movie. I don't know if he was supposed to be Hispanic. I don't think so. But at any rate, the point is that name means something like this, the new life giver or something like that. Maybe new life and or giver, but that's what the name means. I just like to think of it as new life giver. And I think it's a cool name. I really do. So I'm glad that the dog thinks that that should be his name. And he does respond to it. And as far as I know, he's never heard the name before. So he's very young, a few months old, so I don't think he would have had much contact with that. So at any rate, let's talk about animals in general. Animals are the part of life, as you might expect, are animated, where animal came from. And what is animation? Animation is the ability to respond in a fairly significantly short period of time to one's environment. So if you can smell something, hear something, taste something, see something, touch something, or have something touch you, and respond fairly quickly to that that sense that you're having, then you're most likely in the animal kingdom. What if you can't do that? What if you can't respond at all, or if you can respond very slowly? If you can't respond at all, then you're in the mineral kingdom. And if you can respond with an extremely, extremely slow rate to one of those senses, then you are in the plant kingdom. Animals are in the animal kingdom because they can do that. Now, some can do it with only one or a couple of senses, and some can do it with a lot of senses. The more advanced the animal, the more senses it uses at one time to respond to its environment. And the response, generally speaking, is called either an approach or avoidance response. meaning that the animal either cares for the sense that it receives, or it cares to not receive that sense any longer, and it avoids. So that's the reason you have this approach of avoidance response mechanism in animals. Plants do have an approach of avoidance responses as well, but we're mostly unaware of these. They take place so slowly that unless you're going to sit there and look at a plant for hours or days, and this is done in, of course, some types of slow motion, stop motion photography. Yeah, where, you know, they take a slow picture and another slow picture, and over time they add them together, and then you do it real fast, and you can see the plant moving in response sometimes to its environment. But for the most part, people are not aware of it because it's just beyond, too slow for our senses and in a different time frame than the one that we tend to live in. And so we tend to neglect or ignore or be ignorant of the fact that plants have any response at all. Animals we generally know do respond, so we can identify those creatures that are animals by that fact. Now, just because an animal responds doesn't mean it's responding beyond the approach avoidance issue. So if an animal responds beyond the approach avoidance issue, then we call it a more advanced animal, one that has, quote-unquote, thought and possibly feeling connected and or feeling, or I should say feeling and or thought, it could be either way, to the environmental stimulus. And that's not a bit too bad. I mean, if you think about it, and that's what we call a more advanced animal, if you think about it, that kind of definition actually makes sense, you know, of course. And the animals that have mostly feeling responses, we consider those usually the animals that are not close to our species. And they usually are not primary mates to us. So they're not in the primate category. So they don't fit the kind of responses we have. They fit responses considerably different from human beings. And then if they feel and think in any way, or a significant amount of ways, to the stimulus in their environment, then they could enter into the primate category of animals. And those are more like us because they feel and think pretty close together to the same time and to the stimulus, and their animation then resembles some small measure, at least, a human being. And so that's how we come up with that definition. Now, all that makes sense, and I think most people say, oh, I just never thought about that, but that makes kind of sense, you know. And if you're probably an animal biologist or, you know, you study animals in some fashion or various ways, you know, then, you know, even a zoologist, you probably already recognize all the things I just said. Whether you knew them or not, I don't know. The point is, you say, yeah, that's all clear. But that doesn't tell us much about the spiritual life of animals. It's really a very mechanical and, operative way of defining animals. And while it's fairly clear that it's true, it tells us almost nothing about the soul connection and the spiritual connection, which is the thought of God's connection, to the life we call animals. And so that's what really we're going to emphasize in tonight's show, and to clear up a lot of confusion and hopefully get to some, we'll say, higher understandings beyond what I just told you, which is more like the basic level of stuff. All right. So what do I mean by spiritual life? Most people think of spiritual life as being connected to human beings. How do animals have spiritual life? Well, they do, and it comes from the fact that they have a ensouling entity called a group soul that helps a group of like-connected animals. They may be of the same species, they may be of the same family, subspecies, that ensouls a group of animals. Now, you could say, well, why doesn't why don't animals have individual souls like human beings? And the reason is that they don't need it. And that's, let me try to define need here. The animal, because of its relatively non-integrated senses and the relatively longer time it takes for it to feel and think about the senses that it has and integrate that together, causes it to not need an individual soul, which would allow it to think way faster and be more creative about the thoughts that it has in response to the stimulus. Because of that, because animals don't have the mechanisms in their mental apparatus and the complexities in their astral apparatus to sense and to maintain the memory of the senses, the result is, because they don't have that, the quality of their life is more in the moment, lacks a lot of, we'll say, reflective thought about the things that they do, and has almost no future orientation about what is going to do outside of a thing called preconceptual thought, which comes from instinct. Preconceptual thought is actually like an instinct, and that comes from the group soul. So the animals are missing the development of the things that are inside of a human, and they're missing they're lacking the integration of their senses that are inside a human. And the most important part is they're lacking the creative side that humans have, because they are so fixated on wanting to know the concepts of why everything exists, especially why they exist, and why, if so, there is or is not a higher being we call God. Animals just don't have that. And since they don't have it, they don't need an individual soul to guide them. They just need a soul that is a group soul, unless they are a more advanced animal and a pet to a human being. Then, those animals, they're advanced animals. Okay, what is an advanced animal? Well, we already went through that. They have a lot of senses, and they think faster. They have more connection with their feelings and their thoughts together, and they do this, in an integrated fashion, but they still aren't anywhere near the human being level. So they could be a dog. They could be a cat, a horse. They could be a whole bunch of different animals that might be pets to people. And they borrow, then, some of our soul. Our soul. Now, some working animals who aren't pets get a little bit of this anyway, because they're serving humans. More so when they're loved by humans and they're considered pets. I'll explain that in a little while, but at least we can say that there's some benefit to even an animal working for human beings in some capacity. So the interesting thing here is that when we're saying that, well, why is it so important that pets connect with human beings, is because they start using our soul instead of their group soul. Instead of preconceptual thought, they start developing some level of concepts about the world around them. Now, does it get to the point where they start asking, well, where's God, and does God exist, and that kind of stuff? Not exactly, no. That would be a really, really, really advanced animal. There are a few of them. So remember that even though I tell you in general something is a certain way, oftentimes there are exceptions to what I say, because there's always those extreme examples of some great animal who actually has some thought about God. But that's got to be the rarity. Maybe one out of a million dogs. I'm not exaggerating now. That is a pet and well-loved by usually a high consciousness person or persons. May borrow enough of that person's soul to develop some actual thought of a creator in God. We would not necessarily know this. The only way you can really tell that that would be a true statement is that on its own, the animal starts doing, we'll say, a spiritual service of some sort, where their thought truly is for the betterment of other life, and for the other life to have a ability to have greater connection with its soul. That life could be ours or something in its environment. And then we could start looking at that animal as maybe, wow, maybe this is a truly spiritualized animal that is actually somewhat aware of a creator. Now, do they subconsciously have some awareness of any creator? Yes, and this is how. Because the group soul, and or our own, is aware of God. This awareness comes through when the animal does any kind of unselfish or unconditional and or unconditional loving act. And animals do these things. And when they do, they get a little root, like a little feeling about, and maybe a thought, about God. It may not be enough to really be able to formulate a concept, but at least it's enough to give them some experience about it, and that's a good thing. So that's about the most that can happen, and it may be very transient, by the way, in most cases. So maybe a fleeting feeling or thought. For it to be anything lasting, like it's almost permanent in the animal's existence, that would be one of those super advanced cases that I talked about a minute or two ago. So hopefully you're getting a balance here of what I'm trying to say in terms of spiritual life. Now, what does all this mean? It means that animals are really important because they are the part of life that is the intermediary step before life actually moves on to developing human-ensouled life that is far more advanced than the animal, far more creative, thousands of times more in most cases. But there are a few animals that can approach this, even in their mother still animals. And for the most part, the whole animal kingdom won't for maybe thousands of years because, generally speaking, animals advance and all kingdoms advance by the vast majority of the species moving at one time. And it's done at a change in the world itself. And the door opens and a lot of them just advance into the next kingdom. Now, animals advance from one species type to another, usually following a ray line. Some souls actually do intermingle, go from one ray line to another. Majority of souls, group souls, tend to stay within a specific ray line and develop more and more conscious types of that particular ray line. So you see a seventh ray soul developing a lot of different species along the seventh ray, oftentimes specializing in that specific part. Why don't they get good at all of them? Because it diminishes their ability to become great at one. And becoming great at one is more important than becoming an average of all of them, because they're going to become part of a human soul, which is going to absorb seven different ray types anyway. So it's going to want to pick the best of the best of each ray type, so that's what they tend to specialize in. But there are exceptions to that, and you should know that. And the other thing to realize here is to a group soul, its job is to produce in each series of incarnations of its ray line of life the best it can. The best is oftentimes not best by our standards. I mean, you might say, well, I want the best corn. What's the one that's sweetest and does this or that? But that may not be the guidelines for the soul. The soul might say, well, the best corn is the corn that is the most able to adapt, to live, grow, prosper, and flourish. And maybe it may not be as sweet as we like it. Or it might be. Maybe that will make it get to all those other things. And so the group soul moves in that particular direction. However it happens, it goes beyond our very limited understanding natural selection, and also hybriding. These things that we're doing are in ignorance of the process I'm talking about, and it's why we're not doing so well with it. because we just don't understand it, really. If we did, we'd do a lot better, but we don't unless there's some biologists out there, some DNA folks who, you know, who are looking, evolutionary biologists, who are looking for answers beyond their own nose and what their science tells them in the present day sense. But at any rate, and if you are out there and you're thinking, well, maybe this guy's got something to say about this, they give me a call or write me an email or something. I'd love to talk with you about this because there's a lot that can be said, and I could be of a little bit of assistance in helping you maybe inform the rest of the world about the truth about this, is what I call the truth anyway. All right, so the groove souls really don't listen necessarily to the needs of human beings unless that's going to help their particular form of life to really develop more. Sometimes they are trying to survive this in spite of human intervention and destruction of the species that they're helping to create life in. Hybriding is a real dangerous thing for humans because we are so narrow in the qualities that we're looking for in the life forms that we are hybriding. We oftentimes make huge mistakes that cost us in terms of the life that we're trying to create and sometimes creates deadly and even monstrous issues and problems. So we're just not very good at this because we don't know about the spiritual life of animals. We just don't know about it. Or plants. So it is a real hassle to groove souls that humans have taken over so much of their kingdom, especially animals, and we're continuing to interfere with this process. You know, one of the things we do now, we create millions of chickens, okay? But we create them, or sorry, turkeys, the same thing. We create them to be big and lay a lot of eggs, and you know, we literally are mucking around with their genes terribly, to the point where they don't do anything that chickens normally do. They only, you know, lay eggs, but their eggs are pretty poor in quality. If you've had a farm fresh egg, you'll know what I'm talking about. And they also have many other failings, and they produce eggs that are even edible for only a couple, 2-3 years, and they slaughter them. So I mean, you look at this process and you say to yourself, there's something inherently wrong here. They produce inferior eggs. Their laying life is a third of what a regular chicken would be. And they're miserable. They grow them in houses where they can't move. They have no real life to speak of, and they're just machines to us. And we're locking their groove souls into these monstrosities where they can't advance themselves. And they're going to produce a poor result in the human beings that eat the eggs that they lay. I mean, that's a scary thing. I mean, it really is. And that's hybriding. That's what we're doing. Now, can we correct this? Sure, some people are. You know, I'm kind of involved in some experimentation with that. And you can make chickens that are free and have a happy life and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And it can even become pets. Then their eggs become super eggs, and if you eat them, you get super potentials. And the chickens have souls that are different. I know it sounds hard to believe, but they actually have a different soul. And their spiritual life becomes something entirely different. And you could say, well, what happens to the people and their spiritual life who enslave animals and abuse them in such a fashion? I'm going to get into that. You're not going to like to hear it if you're one of the people doing this, but you should know about it. So I'm including that in tonight's show. But at any rate, this is the nature of our problems today. And I don't want to get too negative on this show because there's a lot of positive things to say about the spiritual life of animals. But nonetheless, we should all be cognizant of this because we as consumers are supporting it. That's right. When you want to go to the grocery store and save 30 cents a dozen or whatever it is on eggs, eat those monstrosity of pale-yolked, ill-tasting, almost no-tasting eggs, they're usually stark white, but they have some brown varieties now, too, that aren't much better. And some of them even say free range. I don't know what they call range, because they may maybe increase the square footage from 4 square feet to 5.5 or 6 per chicken. But they're still enslaved, you know, in a building and so. That's not free range, by the way. And there's no law against them right now to say things like that because nobody's looking, nobody cares. But the point is that you want to avoid that. You don't want to support that by buying the eggs, and you don't want to eat those eggs because there's bad karma with them. So they're going to probably produce some trans fats in you and some other awful potential diseases and problems. So it'd be better not to eat them at all than to consume eggs like that. But at any rate, the souls are different, and so we have a difference in the way those chickens are going to evolve, if at all. In general, they stop evolving because they've been hybrided to the point where they can't evolve. As a matter of fact, they may develop a fatal disease and just die off suddenly by millions. This has happened a few times in a few countries. They may develop a sensitivity to a really dangerous disease like bird flu. Now, you might say, oh, but the bird flu is only contagious from chicken to person, and that happens rarely. There's only a few cases a year. Why worry about it? Well, you see, if you keep doing this, the bird flu is the result of the hybriding and the keeping of these chickens in these unholy, terrible ways, under terrible conditions. And you put it all together, and in some countries they're very poor. This happens. They put them in little cages and, you know, keep them in the backyard. They don't have big factories, but they still are abusing the poor birds. And then suddenly the bird flu comes in. H5N1 would be the really dangerous one. That's two different kinds of molecules of a virus that are extremely dangerous. And when you put them together, if it's this particular variety, there's some dangerous, maybe more dangerous ones than this one, it will eventually absorb the ability to hybrid itself or evolve by the lack of the ability for the chickens to adapt to their hybriding, because of a karmic law that's involved, that the species of the infecting organism balances out what's missing in the organism that we're stopping from evolving. So now you've got a fast-evolving virus and an almost stupefied and non-evolving chicken, and you got bad news for humanity because at some time, in the not-too-distant future, that fast-evolving virus is going to become able to go from human to human instead of chicken to chicken and then chicken to human. Once that happens, we could lose billions of people balancing out, as they say in the Matrix, the equation, between those things that humans have done that are hideous and horrible to chickens, and those diseases that come back on us as a result of it. Now, I know I went pretty fast with that. Some people are saying, well, how the heck can I follow all those things you just said? You can re-listen to the show. I can't spend just the 2 hours going over the genetic changes and how it all works out karmically about that one subject because we've got such a broad show tonight. It wouldn't be good. But I said it fast enough. Yeah, so you might get it, and if you didn't get it, you can go back and listen. And I apologize for those that didn't get it the first time. But you'll see that it kind of makes sense after you listen again. And so this is the thing. All right, so now we've got this issue going on, and you might say, well, wow, that's pretty serious. Yeah, it's damn serious because, yeah, while we're killing billions of birds, we're eventually going to kill billions of people. And if you think it's unjustified, then you need to stop the equation, as I put it, and we have to start treating animals, and many people call it humanely, at least more humanely. And there's a lot of other things to be said about this. The same equation could be applied to cows, and then we eat cows, and how many cattle do we, you know, enslave in various ways. With cows, it's particularly about the slaughtering process. But that's really a negative. But there's many other factors involved with how we treat cows that gets into the negative side of the problem. So what happens? Well, you eat a lot of cows, and you end up with a lot of coronary artery diseases that tends to kill a lot of people 20, 30 years before they might live out their life expectancy, with huge costs to the families and the social medical systems from ridiculously priced operations and other things that get into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it doesn't really solve the problem because they only last or tip the equation a bit in the direction of staying alive for 5, 10, or 15 years. So it's not a solution, and it still takes tremendous amounts of time and energy out of the economy for this negative, we'll call it karma, that's taking place on a national level, especially here in the United States, where the consumption of, we'll say, beef is huge, the most in the whole world. And this is no small thing. I mean, we also have the highest level of coronary artery disease. It's not coincidental. It's connected. Now, I'm not like Cornish or like a Cornish, the guy who, you know, says just eat vegetables and it'll be fine. What I'm trying to tell you is it isn't about whether or not you just eat meat. It's about how cows are handled. So it's about something that's hidden. It's the spiritual side of animals that's really being disturbed, that's causing this imbalance. So just eating meat is a different issue. As a matter of fact, once an animal dies naturally, to not eat it is probably bad karma, in some sense. I mean, if there weren't that many animals of that type, eating them would be a moot issue because it wouldn't be enough to feed virtually anybody. And you could feed it definitely to other animals, at least. The problem here is the mistreatment factor. And that's really, so it's more important to know how the animal lived before it was killed and you ate it than whether or not you ate it. Okay, so the spiritual life of animals is a little bit more complicated than what most people would have realized. I understand. Got it. All right. Now, what are some of the other issues in terms of from the animal side? I was just talking from the human side just now, of course. From the animal side, about improving the spiritual life of animals, because we got these group souls that are being hijacked, or their species are being hijacked by humans, because we have intervened now in all three of the lower kingdoms over half the time. Animals, it's a little less than half the time, but plants and minerals, it's above that. So you got this kind of averaging out thing. Now, but we're quickly invading the animal kingdom to the point where it's going to reach half or more. And that could really be a tipping point in terms of seriously limiting the life expectancy of human beings. Because we are doing some pretty terrible things in terms of karmic factors. Eating animals has a peculiar, seductive element to it because it fools us into thinking it's okay for us to do some of these crazy things we do with animals. Let's get into the experimentation mode. We use animals continually to test everything, from cosmetics to new ways of food issues to medical, all kinds of medicines, and testing for drugs, and diseases, test for diseases. We're using animals willy-nilly for this particular genre of kinds of uses. And unfortunately, that carries with it some very negative karma because the animals, not because we use the animals, but because of the way we treat the animals in the use. Now, I know it sounds crazy, but as an intermediary move to try to solve some of the karma from this equation, because all the things that we're trying to do to cure ourselves produces more disease in human beings because we are using so many laboratory rats and sometimes guinea pigs and other animals and dogs, believe it or not, to test for diseases and all kinds of ill effects from various toxic elements in our world. And this is producing the very things that we are trying to treat or cure. Again, I know that this is a very hard thing to accept. So the solution, I don't know if it's a solution completely, but a betterment of the situation would be to treat those animals as kindly and lovingly as possible if we're going to continue to do this. Now, I really would prefer to go the route of doing this all in the mental world, get rid of animals completely, and only do tests on things that are just minimally involved with any level of consciousness if you're going to use a living part of the animal kingdom. Better yet, to just test on DNA levels. But we're too far from that in our science abilities at this time to do that. So at least treat these animals way better than we do. Instead of as objects, give them a more humane world that they live in. Now, for a lot of people, they would say, well, the problem then is if you really show love towards them, and you're not going to go chop their heads off after you've done some kind of crazy, weird experiment to see whether or not they're developing faster Alzheimer's or not. I mean, see, that's the problem. If you go down that road, before long, some of these experimenters are going to develop some conscience, and they're going to have trouble doing the experiments that they used to do. I got it. But that's the best we could do, because otherwise we are creating terrible karma for ourselves. The very diseases that we're trying to improve upon will probably take a leap forward and become worse. Now, if that isn't a bad idea, then I don't know what is. So we really want to try to make some shifts in this, because the spiritual life of animals suddenly is becoming the spiritual life of humans, since we're taking over their kingdom. We're not at the 50% point, but when we do, for animals, tremendously bad karma is going to hit us. I'm going to tell you this most scary thing. I believe this year, 2012, I know the prophecies, is going to be the year we hit the 50% mark minimums. And the scariest thing about that is we could have a major, major worldwide epidemic of some animal-sourced disease, including bird flu. That is scary. We're talking about 1 billion or more people possibly dying. Now, I don't want that to be. I'm not trying to make a prediction that I hope is going to come true. I'm trying to tell how we can avoid it, and I don't want this to come true at all. I'm explaining the metaphysical science behind why this is possible. Now, why is it happening this year? It's because the third ray is so crystallized that our mistreatment of animals is kind of peaking, and our misuse of animals is the worst thing, but the mistreatment added to the misuse is just horrendous for this coming year. And it may not get any worse, but this year may reach a point where we actually create a truly evil, truly terrible epidemic, a pandemic. Yeah. Okay, so listen, we're going to come back and talk a lot more about this. I don't mean to be all negative. There's some positive things, believe me. But I had to cover this in the first part because, I don't want to get rid of it over as fast as possible. And we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes, give or take, from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about the spiritual life of animals, including pets. And our engineer, Seth, had a question about, what about eggs? Are there good eggs and bad eggs, et cetera? Well, I did mention that some eggs are better than others, obviously based upon how the chickens themselves are living. And that has a lot to do with human beings. But in terms of what you would prefer eating, it's better that the chicken egg never had any possibility of conscious life in it. Now, let me explain what that means. The possibility of conscious life comes from fertilization. Many people think it's better to eat fertilized eggs. I'm not going to argue with that issue, except to think this. If the egg had never become fertilized, then there was no possibility of conscious life ever in that egg. And that would be the better egg to eat, because there is no associated possibility of destruction of future life. Now, if the egg is fertilized, but quickly, in effect, killed by the fact that it's chilled or not handled properly, it probably doesn't make a lot of difference. But an egg that is along the process and starts developing a chicken, if you eat an egg like that, that's going to cause you a bit more problems. Because although you still can say, well, it died pretty early, it was only 2 or 3 days that it developed. Yeah, I understand that, but actually that egg is much more on the process of developing life. And it's better that you don't mess with those eggs, because there's so many that aren't like that. Now, it's similar to the concept of why and I talk about abortion and the question of when does life begin for a human being. It's much later, luckily. And it's after the first trimester, I'll tell you that. It's at least probably a week to 3 or more weeks after the first trimester before, and there's some variability, so I can't be exact, when a soul connects to the fetus. After that, you're dealing with a viable life form with consciousness. And it would be at that point, I would say, you should stop, in most cases, having abortions. Now, I know that that's not the true way that the law is put in place in this country, and certainly not in other countries. I think it's 26 weeks on average, which is way too late, because the first trimester plus a few weeks would be something at or less than 20 weeks. So you're 6 weeks beyond that if you're going to 26 weeks. And, you know, there's proof that fetuses have lived to 23 and a half weeks on life support, et cetera. It's not easy, but some of you have. So you don't, you know, anytime you know that to be true, then you know that souls and soul fetuses at an earlier time than what we expect, and we shouldn't be interfering with life at that point. So I'm against abortions past about 20 weeks or so, give or take, but I think it's a little safer to go early than late because it's all a guesstimate. The soul has options about exactly when it is sold, and you don't know. We don't know when that might be. It's the only way you can know is afterwards, because if the fetus dies because it has perfect living conditions, then most likely it wasn't insulted. But it's kind of like after the fact, and I don't know how you can figure it out beforehand, so yeah, it doesn't do you a lot of good. Now, the chicken and the egg thing is the same thing on a much more simplistic level. And so it becomes, it becomes a bit of an issue. Now, I realize what I also said just now about abortions and human beings, but highly inflammatory for some folks. Some folks believe that there's human life or potential for human life, and they say potential is all that counts. Well, I mean, not really. It isn't all that counts, but there's potential from the point that the egg is fertilized, and some people believe even an unfertilized egg should not be destroyed or harmed or whatever because it has potential too. Okay, well, then you get into this reductio absurdum argument that then, you know, every time you breathe in some bacteria, you're killing life. And, I mean, you go into all the crazy things about what life is and isn't, et cetera. But I think that my rational way of looking at it is about when we know something has been sold, it has life. And that's when you really want to be very careful about how you're dealing with it. In comparison, when it isn't insult. And that's a much better, I think, way of defining life in terms of abortions. I'm not in favor of abortions at all, but I'm just letting you know that since people have the right, in my mind, to be free to make these decisions themselves, if you're going to make any laws against abortions, it should be about the issue of the soul, and therefore you could use the trimester, first trimester, plus a week or two or whatever, as some kind of guide for the time frame. And it still gives people, then, obviously, the option to get an abortion, just not a late-term one, or by our standards, late. And, I guess one way to look at it is, if a woman has lived for 17 or 18 weeks pregnant, and she hasn't yet decided, or hasn't yet figured out, that what to do about her pregnancy, or even if she is pregnant, maybe she just loses the right for the abortion option at that point. Something to consider, way different than the present polarized pair of opposites condition about life. And the way I talked about it in the textbook Life and Meaning, because as far as I know, what I'm saying is the truth, and truth tends to trump all the different arguments because it gives you a much clearer understanding and a much wiser one to make a informed decision about laws and ways of operating. I'm not so sure that laws are the best way. Maybe education is. If we can teach this to people, then I don't think it's necessary to have laws. Because people, once they're educated about it, most people don't want to kill something that's truly alive. They wouldn't. And maybe the few that would, it's so de minimis in the scope of things, you don't need to have the law anyway. Even though life is precious, and you can say, well, if you can save one life, it's worth having the law. Maybe not, because it might kill a bunch more other people from some other angle. You got to look at all the sides. All right, back to this question then. Okay, so life is the operative here. When is it practical? When does it make sense that something is insulted to the point that now it's truly a life form, regardless of what we think about it, and should we be destroying or disrupting or interrupting that life form's further growth? And that's how we should look at animals in terms of and doing anything with them, in terms of experiments, eating them, sports, shooting them, hunting, in other words, for reasons outside of food sources. I mean, just all kinds of things. And you got to look at this from from those perspectives if you're going to have some kind of understanding of the spiritual life of animals. Otherwise, it escapes us. Now, what about the folks that follow spiritual religious practices, but not necessarily religious practices, but more spiritual, which like the many forms of American Indians do, they have a spiritual understanding about animals. They think animals have spirits, which is God's thought. Remember that. It's part of God. It's part of God is in each animal. And before they usually kill animals, they have some respectful understanding of the spirit in the way that they kill the animal, the way they hunt the animal, the way they keep animals has a lot to do with this spirit concept. Well, actually, they're closer to the truth than most modern non-Indian Americans and other folks are, you know, in the world. So they've got it more figured out just from the standpoint that their religion, if you call it that, is a spiritual religion that connects them to the understanding of the spiritual life of animals. Now, the other thing to realize here is the spirit that is in an animal can become darkened by the way the animal is mistreated by humans and can disconnect from its soul and from God and become infected or, let's say, under the control of evil, the dark side, producing some very dark spirits. And the animal itself can become vicious, destructive, infected, non-nutritious, poisonous, both in direct contact or even eating human beings, and to other animals that may eat it as well. This is very strange. You might say, well, wait a second. So the spirit of animals could become, in a way, not spiritual, because lose God. The spirit itself loses its spiritual nature and loses its connection with God and becomes possessed by darkness, and then becomes destructive to life in many ways. Even if other animals eat the animal that's possessed, they may die too. This is strange to us. Now, we talked about all those chickens and turkeys that are factorized in terrible conditions. Can they become possessed? Kind of. It's a very strange kind of possession, and I'll try to explain it to you in a way that I understand it. The group source of evil, one of its jobs is to convince the people that handle these animals and then own the factories, usually they're wealthier people and wealthier groups of people, to produce animals that are more and more non-nutritious and in some ways carry more and more de facto kinds of diseases that may not be so terrible like bird flu to kill people almost instantly, but carry with it all kinds of sub-diseases that eat up the speed up the aging process and destroy some of the quality of life of those that eat animals, which is mostly, but not all, humans. Sometimes we feed these animals to our pets. And so the results are that we are reducing our life expectancy and eating ourselves through high oxidized things. The animals are sometimes pumped up with hormones and terrible other kinds of chemicals to try to keep these diseases at bay and to improve their growth rate because of the diseases and other issues about the way they're kept, to the point where eating them is toxic in very, very serious ways, including the very hormones that they're fed. It's a bizarre kind of world, isn't it? And so eating animals has inherent in it a kind of aging, destructive to the physical system process, and et cetera, that's hidden in the karma of the spiritual life of the animals being seriously disrupted. And in some cases, in a general sense, at a low level of possession of huge factories of animals, or huge stockyards of animals, or huge whatever. And you might say, well, some cattle roam free. Yeah, but eventually they take them in and fatten them up, you see, and they feed them even concrete and bullshit stuff. It's crazy. And, I mean, it's nonsense, because ultimately they are tremendously mistreated. And when they're rounded up, they're usually mistreated personally, too. I mean, you know, everything from the castration process, because they're made in steers, or they're, you know, if they're milked, they're just at a factory, they can barely move around. And it's, you know, I mean, there's so many, many, many things that are wrong. And then we wonder why we have so much illness and so much problems with our aging process. It has to do with our monkeying around with and interfering with the spiritual life of animals. Now, some of you might be saying, well, vegetarians are eating plants. What about the plants? The plants were made to be eaten. They don't deteriorate by even some levels of hybriding by humans. They actually thrive in most times, most ways, humans handle them. Some ways of hybriding destroy them too. But none of it, like GMO issues. I mean, when you get down to the genetic level and you start making them goofy plants that are resistant to Roundup and that absorb, therefore, Roundup in their environment, because they can resist it, but we don't have the resistance in our body, and so we eat them and we get Roundup from them, which is a serious poison, by the way, causes all kinds of cancers and stuff. That's a dangerous thing. That's a real dangerous thing. No kidding. That's serious stuff. Those kinds of hybridings are very, very dangerous, and that's rampant now. Now you say, well, why are we doing it? Well, because we wanted to be able to spray Roundup, literally the product Roundup, and related toxic herbicides around the plants so that the weeds will be killed off, the plants won't. So we hybrid the plants to be totally resistant to this Roundup, but they absorb it then into their system, and then we eat the Roundup. And we don't have the resistance to the Roundup the way the plant does. And the resistance to the Roundup has its own complex problems with our hormones. So it produces another kind of toxicity. So between these two levels of toxicity, these plants become really bad for us. Whole other thing, whole other problem. Okay. So, plants in general, except for the really badly hybrid ones, are great for us to eat. Animals generally are not good for us to eat. The products of animals, like milk and eggs, actually aren't too bad for us to eat, provided the animals are treated very humanely. They aren't fed hormones, and they aren't fed, and they aren't in a factory producing milk or whatever, and everything done around them is quote-unquote more organic. That's not too bad. And then if you can eat those sources of eggs and milk and cheese, you're going to be a lot better off. But it's not the perfect. The perfect would be if the animals really were treated with love instead of being what I call work product animals who are still producing food more than they are loved. If you eat the food that an animal is loved produces, that's when you get the best results, because animals that are loved help their group souls to grow, develop a closer spiritual connection with God through their group soul, and are almost protected from possession. And so it produces some really good food, and that food is fine. And even when the animal eventually dies, you can feed it to your dogs or cats or whatever, if that's the way you want to use the leftover animal pie. Could you eat the animal yourself and still get away with it? Yeah, you could. But if you love the animal enough, it's going to be too hard to do that, and that's the proof that you do love it enough. So the answer is it's sort of foregone conclusion. You're not going to be eating the animal that you love. So that would be a self concluding process, and we don't have to really argue with them. All right. At any rate, back to this concept then. If animals have a true spiritual life, which they do, then what does that mean in terms of where they're going to go and what they're going to do after their physical life, which still is not the, it's just as hard for animals or more so than it is for people in the present-day world because of the way people are treated. We'll go into that in a minute or two. I wanted to tell you about Phi Chi Jisik because I didn't have a chance in the last couple of shows to mention about it. And Phi Chi Jisik, if you have a lot of problems, is a great product. It gets rid of a lot of what I call various kinds of more chronic pains, and it can deal even with acute pains at the time. You just have to take a lot of it. Now, most people say, yeah, but you've got a lot of conditions on you, you have to take a lot of pills. That's absolutely true. But as an analgesic, I don't know of a better one, truly. So you might want to give it a try. It doesn't work as well with people who smoke, and the more meat you eat, it will probably have a reduced benefit. Also, because of tonight's show and the things I'm talking about. You can go to buyjisik.com or call 602-431-5762 and find out about Jisik. If you haven't tried it, you should also look into Soul Balance, because right now there's a really bad A-type flu that's floating around the country, causing a lot of pneumonias and bronchitis and other associated issues. Because it's causing so much pneumonia, you may get just pneumonia, even though you don't even have the flu. That's happened to somebody I knew. This is kind of a rare event, by the way, if you're young and healthy. Older folks, you know, like 60 and over, pneumonia is dangerous. But it seldom happens to people in their 30s or 40s. And if it does, it's because there's just so many pneumonia germs around because the flu is already incubating that. And the flu is viral, but these viruses are teaming up with bacterial infections day in and out and doing real havoc. The flu and pneumonia go together like, you know, hot dogs and buns. They just love each other. So you need to think about Soul Balance because it's able to deal with flus real well. That doesn't mean you may not need a thing like Tamiflu or amantadine or the two in combination to deal with some of the viruses that are producing the flus. And type A flus are very bad flus because they hang on, and you think you got rid of it, and they're back in. And they wear you out. They wear out your immune system, and then they can kill you. So they're really dangerous. They take longer, usually, to incubate than many of the type B flus. But once they got you there, it's just nastier than you ever get out. And every so often, the type A flu takes the prominence. Most of the shots include maybe one type A and two types B, sometimes all type B, but they don't get it right very often. The A that eventually comes out, 9 times out of 10, I think, is something different than what was in the shot. So the shot didn't really immunize you against it anymore. Sometimes it may even alter your immune system. Let me explain this. I know that a lot of people don't believe this, but you get a flu shot, and your immune system is kicked in for the three kinds of varieties of flu that they think is going to happen that year. You say, oh, that's great, man. I'm really protected against those three. But then 4, 5, and 6 varieties come out instead of the three that they picked, and your immune system's been all hyped up and used. Literally, most of it has been arranged to be increased at the cost of it producing other kinds of antibodies towards the three that didn't come out. So then what happens is that when a new one comes out that wasn't in the shot you got, you're more likely to get that flu than if you never got the shot in the first place. How many times have you thought about it and said, gee, you know, I got a shot this year and I got the flu. Last year I didn't get a shot and I didn't get the flu. That's the reason why. Immunization only works when you have a very specific type of bacteria or flu that you're immunizing against and you know exactly the way it's going to be. When you start doing these, we'll call it generic immunizations, and you pick 3 winners at the cost of 7 or 10 losers, you usually lose. Nobody has ever explained this correctly, I'm afraid. And I don't know why immunization biologists and doctors don't know what I'm saying, because it's completely logical if you look at the statistics about it, to realize that immunizations for a general three picks of a flu is not a good deal. It's a negative, because it's only so much potency in each person's immunity. And if you pump up one side, you lose something on the other. Okay, so just think about that. And also think about soul balance, because it could save your life and it also could make you feel a lot better. Generally speaking, when you get an A-type flu, if you start soul balance within the first 24 hours, especially if you can get a hold of some Tamiflu and or amantadine, and take those with it, you will start feeling better much more quickly. And you'll be able to handle for the first 3 to 5 days, when the flu is really going to come on strong, most of the side effects, most of the malaise, most of the symptoms. You may still need to take Gzyk and or, you know, something to reduce your fever, because your fever can still go up even though you don't have any other symptoms. Fever is not good because it further lowers your immunity. Now you could say, but fever is good because viruses don't live very well at those higher temperatures. Wrong. Viruses don't care about the temperature of your body. They like hotter temperatures. It's the bacteria that don't live very well at higher temperatures. Viral infections are helped by fevers. Only bacteria are reduced in their ability to be, we'll say, energized and infected, more able to reproduce by high fevers. So if you have a viral infection, you're not going to be helping yourself by running any kind of high fever. It is true if you had a purely bacterial infection, a fever actually might slow down the infection. Better to kill the infection off in the first place than get the fever. But that's regardless. Fevers overall, over a long period of time, are very destructive because they do lower your immune system over time and your ability to even function. You know that. You get a fever, you can barely move. Right? Yeah, okay, if it's a high fever, true. Yeah, and it can eventually cause brain damage, leads into all of the more serious brain ailments and other kinds of serious infections of the organs in the body. So fevers are really bad news. Our own bodies just stop working. All right, enough of that. Back to the rest of the concept of the spiritual life of animals. I threw a lot in that commercial, didn't I? A lot of stuff about genetics. All right, back to the spiritual life of animals. So animals have this a really cool, we'll say, spiritual life, but we don't even know about it, because most people don't know what happens when you die. And so we think, well, a bunch of rats died in some kind of experimental laboratory, and they're just gone. Nah, they're not gone. Even though they're fairly, and by our standards, low-level animals, they're actually not. Rats are not primates, but they're more advanced than we think in terms of their actual abilities. Even lab rats are. And even though they're genetically made to be susceptible to diseases and certain other things, they still have way more senses and abilities than most other animals do. And they end up going to some of the lower subplanes of the astral world for a brief life, usually a year or two. And they actually hang out there. And they can be kind of pesky little boogers, because animals in the astral world have some of the same abilities as humans do. Because the quantum constant is so much larger, and energy follows thought so much greater than it does, the results are pretty much remarkable. And I mean remarkable. The process of this thing is hard to even understand from our perspective, because we don't see these spiritual issues in these animals. They actually can create, for a large part, with their creative imagination, movement and change in their environment. Rats may like certain kinds of environments, and they can actually create some of those environments in the astral world. There are environments that oftentimes aren't antithetical to the way the humans want to live. And they actually fight with the humans about the environmental changes. Let me give you an example. Let's say you're in the sixth sub world, which is kind of not a very friendly, wonderful, warm, and friendly place to be, because you're living mostly through how you feel. The rats are there, too. Yeah, they are there in huge numbers. No kidding. Even in the fifth sub world, this is also true. What are they doing? Well, they're kind of fighting the creative imagination of the human folk. Let me give you some examples for both the sixth and the fifth sub world. And if, in the sixth sub world, you find rats that are mostly wild animals that have been, sometimes poisoned by humans. Sometimes they just live their life out in sewers. They foul people pretty much. And they're in the outskirts, and sometimes right in the middle of some of the towns and cities in the sixth sub-world. And they don't just live in sewers. They actually, you could be living in your own little apartment there, or house. And you've created with your astral imagination, and things look pretty good. And you go to bed one night, so to speak. You don't sleep as long in the astral world, but you sleep a little. Sleep some. And you wake up the next, quote-unquote, morning or sometime later. And the next thing you know, your bed's been turned into kind of a rat nest. And there's rats all around you. And the walls of your house have been decayed and have chew marks on them. And, the parts of the whole surroundings have been ratified, I'll call it, by things that rats like. You find little baby rats all over the place. And I mean, it's pretty gross, right? I mean, I don't want to make this sound horrible, but and then you have to use a lot of your creative imagination to drive them out and to put the place back in order, only to have it happen again the next time. And you're on a losing battle with this thing because there's more and more rats and a very limited amount of your creative imagination because your senses are diminishing each day you live in this world because people are so selfish. Eventually, you could be displaced by the rats. You may even get your body may get eventually eaten by the rats. If that happens, and enough of your senses are gone, you die from the asteroid. But what a way to go. Now, let's go to the fifth subworld. Fifth subworld, the rats are more laboratory kinds of rats, usually experimented on by scientists with their fifth-rate nature. These rats have an even more insidious kind of strange behavior. They're not so motivated by how they feel as much as motivated by their general, I'll call it, antipathy and hostility towards scientific-minded people. They actually are attracted to people who experimented on them in the past. And they actually have an axe to grind. So they go after those folks in the fifth subworld that actually did that at the time. And how do they wear away on them? Well, it takes a lot longer, and usually they're not going to eat the person. But they really play with their minds and their environment. Someone may have a really wonderful home and garden and live in a very nice community, but for some darn reason, their windows keep disappearing because the rats go in. And they change the windows into nice, holy places where all kinds of other things come flying or moving into the home. And they might have some interesting inventions, so to speak. They're fifth subworld inventions. They aren't really that advanced, but they're somewhat to the kinds of things that we might at times want to have here. And those inventions keep getting gnawed on and broken down so they don't operate in the fashion that they want them to, and it's kind of an endless process of having to use one's creative imagination to recreate them, only for the rats collectively with their minds to destroy them, and sometimes they actually, in some pseudo-physical way of behaving, go in and bite and gnaw on these devices and things. It is absolutely hilarious if you're sitting as a bystander to watch this craziness going on. And the rats are specific towards the individuals that they want to do because they hunt them out. They want to go after the folks that created the problems for them. It may not be the scientists, it might be the suppliers of rats. But whoever they are after, someone that involved themselves usually in the physical world before they got there, to the astral world. I'm just giving an example. This happens with all kinds of other animal life, including insect life. So before you start going out wantonly using and abusing animals, consider your next life, where you may end up, and what those animals may be doing to you while you live there. Now, some of you are going to say, well, I love animals, and I don't want to do any of this stuff. But remember your secondary behaviors. By supporting it in the society you're in, because of group and national karma, you're still absorbing some of this karma in yourself. So, you know, if you say, well, I'm not going and torturing the animals myself, but I'm paying for people to do it through the cost of the buying the products made out of animals or made from animals or whatever, you're still doing it. And you're still going to have some karma associated with it. And making your potential astral life somewhat hideous caused by animals that live there after their life here in the physical world. Now, this pretty much ceases to be a big problem once you get to the fourth subworld or the third. Because in those subworlds, most people have not lived their life in that way. And so the worlds themselves don't reflect these kinds of annoying, if at the least, and sometimes life-threatening results. Seventh subworld can be downright scary because the animals that go there are affected so much by evil around them. A few are, by the way, as well as the sixth subworld, that they're possessed by evil. And then they just literally directly attack humans in monstrous forms. You don't even know what kind of animal they came from anymore because they've been so monstrous-sized to the point where you may not be able to tell what they are. They're just monsters created by evil ones in the eighth sphere. It's a crazy bus, crazy thing to have happen. And it goes on all the time. So the spiritual life of animals has a direct effect on the spiritual life of humans in the lower subworlds of the astral world. And it's no easy thing to correct it once it happens in the astral world because the cause is here, not there. It's very difficult to change. And sometimes people succumb to the results of it. And it may end their astral life for that particular personality. All right, what about the good life of spiritual life of animals? Well, that's pretty cool. Animals that haven't been significantly mistreated go to the astral world and usually have a much better life. Pets, amazingly. They are almost instantly gobbled up by people in the fifth and particularly the fourth and third astral subworlds. That they're relished there because they are treated with great love and they become really wonderful animals. They're like the perfect pets in many respects. They bring great joy and love into the lives of the residents. And the animals that reach the second subworld become childlike and are treated more as children than as animals. First subworld, it's almost indistinguishable between an animal that reaches the first subworld and an actual child that reaches the first subworld. You rarely tell the difference because their consciousness is so expanded by the quantum conscious changes and the fact that they can get to those levels of existence without falling asleep. I mean, that's a really advanced animal now. An animal that has started the individual process towards becoming a human being while they were physically alive. Or they don't make it up to that level. And so it's a pretty cool thing to see animals like that because it's like more like seeing kids. And they're relished and loved and, just a great experience to watch it happen. It brings warmth to your heart, tears to your eyes, and makes you say, wow, this is worth living for just to even observe this. This is a great thing. So, spiritual life for animals varies to depending upon how they were treated by humans. Now, I've got to tell you, and I hope you're picking this up right now, the way we treat animals is more important than the way we treat each other as people, because the karmic consequences to us is greater than how the karmic consequences in most circumstances is how we treat people. So if you're nasty to a spouse or a friend or to an enemy, it's not as bad than if you're nasty to a poor animal and has almost no ability to defend itself and no ability to change the outcome of your torturous, negative, hostile, inhumane, destructive nature. And the karma is very much worse per action done. This is stated, by the way, in many spiritual books, not just by me. I don't want you to think, well, where do you get that from? No, it's stated. But the reasons for it are usually not. I hope tonight's show is starting to reveal these reasons so that people will start, you know, taking notice and, like, saying, well, maybe this guy's right about this because it kind of makes sense. And if we don't want to be so diseased, if we don't want to age so much, and if we want to live a much better life, even while we're physically alive, I suppose astrally, then we need to treat animals in a really wonderful way, or else it's bad for all. And this is something that affects everybody. So you can't just say, well, I'm being good enough for me, but I won't worry about how other people treat animals, because you got to get involved with it. You can't just say, oh, cool, I did good my job, I'm done. Because we're collectively held responsible in this karmic aspect, especially as we're moving now towards this great event where half of the animal kingdom is going to be controlled by the effects of human beings. Part of that is because we're losing animal species, by the way. And as that happens, as we reduce the number of species by our actions, then the remaining animals are more affected by us in a ratio proportion, which causes karma to accelerate, for more negative karma to be developed. So you can see this all coming towards us. It's moving ahead at a rapid rate. And the process is unfortunate because it does not have within it any, you know, like redeeming things that you can do. You can't, on an individual basis, things necessarily change. You've got to really work to do it for the whole country you're in, the whole world you're in. Or you may suffer consequences. Remember about pandemics. That's a worldwide event. You might say, well, but I treated my own dog so well. Why do I have this fatal flu? Because it's a worldwide event. It's affecting the whole world, and you're part of it. And because we're coming to this big tipping factor that's so big that it will just affect us in a bigger way. More than half of the animal kingdom is being directly affected by human beings. The more animals that we mistreat in large numbers through factories and, you know, stockyards and whatever, the more it accelerates the process moving by just sheer numbers. So that maybe give you some reasons why you might want to be an animal rights person. I know it's a selfish side, and it has a double-edged sword for using wrong motive, but the point is that just plain old simple sense tells you this is bad news if it keeps going on. So I don't want to say being a radical, you know, like you'll throw paint on people or whatever if they're wearing some kind of animal thing. Sometimes it's good to use animal products like leather or whatever, if there's no other use for them, because, and especially if you're killing cows to eat, because it gives some meaning to the life of what that animal was beyond the fact you ate them. So in a weird way, it's not necessarily bad to wear leather. What's bad is to eat them. Eat the cows in the first place, and an inhumane way we keep them is far worse than the fact we eat them. So, I mean, the whole thing has just this whole karmic ratio thing that is tipping so dramatically against humanity. And that's the reason we have pandemics. It's the reason we have ill health. It's the reason we have poor nutrition. It's the reason so many children suffer, because the nutritional aspects affect them first and most severely. I mean, it's just a lot of things to consider about the present state of the world. And I know that many people haven't thought about this. So this is a thoughtful, hopefully, program tonight. Okay, what about the group souls in the astral and mental world? There's some minimal mental life to most advanced primates, but mental life is de minimis compared to astral life in terms of animals. What is the factor then in terms of group souls? Well, the animals that live in the higher subworlds contribute huge amounts of positive development to the group soul. Those are good things for them. The animals in the lower subworlds that are acting out towards humans and that have other issues, those animals oftentimes, particularly if they're possessed by evil, are still acting in a destructive fashion to the group soul. And the group soul sometimes does not recover well from this. So the next round of animals have even more problems, more issues with human beings, more issues with genetics and issues that involve the very survival and adaptability of the species. They don't come up with good instinctual behaviors. They come up with instinctual behaviors that are counterproductive to the existence of the animal, like turtles crossing roads and all kinds of crazy stuff. And so the instincts get afoul. They don't move towards survival. They move towards destruction because the group soul's all messed up. Because it doesn't get accurate information, it can't make preconceived decisions that in any way resemble survival. And so they become more extreme kinds of instincts that lose the adaptability of keeping the animal alive and healthy and wealthy and well, etc. And so you get group souls that are just a mess. This is not a tenable life situation. And it causes some implosion in the process of life development. That's a very bad thing, because when you get down to the physical level, when you have this implosion mechanism going on, you end up with gaps in the evolutionary process of life. And as the gaps start joining together, all life starts becoming more and more into jeopardy. The holes or gaps we see today are minimal compared to what we may see 20, 40, 60 years, and 100 years into the future, in which life starts literally collapsing on the higher levels. Animals will almost disappear in many respects, and the variety of animals go so low that we really won't have a pool strong enough to keep most animal life alive. That is a terrible outcome, and it usually leads to the destruction of human life in the end. So we need to be looking forward to how we can solve these issues today, especially now that this may be the really bad year for things, that we try to correct everything maybe by 2025, and it has to be a more consciously selected correction because it's so complicated and because most people won't change if they don't have an understanding of these principles and angels' wisdom and science. It's part of genetics as well. We just have to understand genetics from a broader perspective than the pure evolutionary model of survival of the fittest and certain other ingredients in that model that presently are misunderstood. Like, as I was explaining earlier in the commercial segment, about how when we make immunizations that are generalized and not specific enough and don't show enough wisdom, we create ill health in ourselves. Something that we're, the absolute unintended purpose, the unintended result is the antithesis of the reason we create the vaccine. So the vaccine becomes counterproductive to the disease process itself, and we increase flu. And it doesn't solve the problem that we're making the vaccine for. That's one example of what I'm talking about. If we're going to make this shift, we don't have a lot of time. It's 2012. If it's the next 13 years we're talking about, then how are we going to do it? And the answer is education, because we can't do it through regulation. And we're not going to be able to achieve that. That would be a first and third way approach, first being governmental, third way using principles involved with action and interaction between people. Those things are not going to work. If you try them, they will fail. So you've got to use the education model. And the problem is the education that needs to be used is principles and angels' wisdom. And some of the ideas that I'm saying on this show and other people may be saying in some other quarters of the metaphysical, spiritual, educational part of life. And if we don't get that out there quick enough, after 2025, it's possible this collapse of life could start becoming sequential and the holes could start connecting. And when that happens, once the spiritual life of animals is really seriously disrupted, human life is in grave danger. Because the connection between plants and humans, animals, if you eliminate most of the animal life, human life in any future generations is dubious at best. And that means the population of the world will decline from possibly 2025, which may be its peak, of maybe 7.5 billion people, maybe 8 billion. It may drop precipitously to under 3 billion by 2050. And then it could take another drop below 1 billion by 2075. So these kinds of precipitous drops in human life would tremendously weaken human civilization, but more importantly, would lead to possibly a loss of consciousness in general in humanity caused by the strife of such fast declines in the numbers of human beings. There just won't be enough people to keep the cultures and technologies available. And civilization will decline so rapidly that people will be struggling at levels that you haven't lived at for the last several hundred years, that people will go backwards in time to maybe 500 years ago in their life cycle. But their stamina to survive that kind of experience and their abilities will have declined. So that while we could live that way 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago, in 2050-75, we may lose that adaptation ability, and it may put us on the brink of total annihilation, particularly if there is a series of events, or one or more catastrophic events, that could wipe out the human race. If that happens, the experiment of Earth is over, most likely, and Earth will be thrown away, basically, as a, where evil took over, darkness took over the planet, and we were unable to overcome this, and we became victims to our own karma, and it all happens with this link between animals connected to plants and humans. And the whole system just falls apart. Now, many other things happen in the process, diseases, variety of life falls apart. And then there's a collapse in the hybridization of certain things that were weak to begin with and wrongful. but they were able to survive because there were enough variety of other species that kind of filled in certain gaps in certain ways. But now those don't exist anymore, and everything falls apart. Doing this quickly, I could explain why step by step, but it's too much time in the time we have left to even explain that one part. But you can kind of see how this might work, even if you can't put it all together right now. Okay, what can we do? Where's the positive side of this? Because we need some help here pretty quick. Well, the first thing is that obviously this has got to get taught. And it's got to get taught to people that are very resistant to hearing it because it's a scientific community that is most failing to understand this. I mean, truly, believe it or not, people who are more religiously founded would probably agree with me much more than the scientific community, right? Because they're so married to a wrongfully understood evolutionary model. They refuse to understand spirit, so they can't understand the spiritual life of animals, including pets, and so they don't understand the problem. Because you have to believe there is such a thing as spiritual life and spirit. And if you don't believe that, if you're an atheist or whatever your religion might be, if you don't believe in spirit, then you believe in a mechanical model of evolution, which is totally different than what I just explained, and you never see it coming. And by the time it does come, you never understand what it was that happened, except you knew you got rolled over by a bulldozer, but you just never put two and two together, so you can't, even after it's all over, you just don't know what happened. So that's what this show's about, is trying to get at the folks that are hardest to get at. Now, are we going to be successful? I don't know. I can't really tell you if we will succeed, but you can help others by telling them about this show, especially scientific types, explaining some of the things I've explained tonight, and get them to start thinking about it. They might say, well, actually, that model might be true, what that guy's saying is, because it is true, in my opinion, but they might actually say it's even logical, it even makes sense. I never just thought about it that way. So they might start, saying it's not all quackery and wackery. It may be the evolutionary model that they believe in is a wrong kind of evolution because it's so mechanical. There is no spirit or God in it, and it ignores some of the principles that they need to have a grasp of to see the truth on what's going on. You can recommend Life, Sin, and Meaning. It's a textbook. And scientific type of people actually have the intellectual capacity to understand that book without even having it being taught. But they don't have the consciousness necessarily. The book will help them develop some of the consciousness. And they might say, this book isn't all hogwash. It actually makes a little bit of sense. It may trip a lot of, prejudicial novels about some social agendas they might have. But if they can quell those, even including like the abortion thing I talked about earlier, if they can quell those things long enough to read this kind of material somewhat open-minded, they certainly can call me or write to me. I'm always grateful to hear from folks who don't agree but are willing to talk about it. So we can discuss it. But we need to get to some of these folks because they are controlling much of what's happening. And in doing so in some very, very bad ways. Now, they're going to say, of course, well, I'm green, I'm very environmentally friendly, so what if I don't believe in God? And so what if I don't believe in evolutionary models that aren't mechanical? And so what's the problem? Well, you can explain it something like this. That if they're wrong, and there is a God, and if spirit is God's thought, then it has to be part of life or there is no life, they're missing almost everything that is critical about their own survival in the next umpteen decades. And there may be no way to change it in just a little over one of them. And so it's worthwhile to maybe give up some of their prejudice in thought to examine this other side. And maybe you can convince them of that. I can, because I won't turn on the show and listen to it, and they won't read the books. So if you're friends with folks that, or if they're part of your family, you happen to listen, but they don't, or if they're just people you know, maybe you work with them, and you're the unusual bird who isn't the person that feels and thinks the way they do, you might be able to kind of introduce them to this. This is a plea to all of you out there to do something, because remember, the spiritual group I'm part of and other people, their spiritual groups, are of de minimis amounts of ability to really get it to people. People listen to people they know much more than people that are on the radio or write some weird book. That's what it's about. You see, if you can talk to them as a friend or as a coworker, there's a better chance you'll make an inroad than saying, well, turn the show on and listen to it no matter what, today, right now. They're not going to be open and wise enough, to, if you could even get them to listen to it for more than 5 minutes, to make a difference. So that approach is probably not going to work. But the approach of you talking, you explaining what you can, and then say, let's listen to one of his prior shows together. And you turn on tonight's show. It's called The Spiritual Life of the Animals, Including Pets. And they're probably going to go running for the door, but you grab them and say, well, come on, sit down. Let's listen to this show. You tell me if what this guy is saying makes any sense at all, and if it doesn't, why not? What is there that's so wrong about what he's suggesting to think about here? Because if he's right, we got some real bad problems that we have to consider in terms of what we're doing. You might be working with and in an industry that helps to grow birds, chickens, and turkeys, and whatever, that produce more and more worthless eggs. That's something to consider, too. Maybe you want to leave that part of the industry and go into free ranching, free open ranges, you know, kinds of, you know, you still have the resumes, you still have all the abilities to do that, just raise different kind of chickens and turkeys. And, you know, you don't have to change your diet, you don't have to change and become vegetarian, but you can make a difference, and that difference may save. So these are pretty important things to kind of consider and think about. What else can we do? Well, it would be worthwhile if you do know of some groups that you think are being into this stuff in a way that would be helpful. They might be what I call first level groups. They're not necessarily, your whole life is not necessarily committed to it, and maybe you'll only do it a few hours, 30 to 10 or whatever, hours a week. But whatever it is, it's something to join others who have similar ideas. Because as a collective force, you can work together with them much better than trying to do something on your own. Yes, you can on your own talk to the people you work with and talk to the people you know, but if you want to do something in a wider spread situation, better to get together with a group of people. Now, a spiritual group oftentimes doesn't think of themselves as a spiritual group. They may just be people who love this sort of animal or this sort of group of animals, and they want to protect them or help them. But it's still spiritual. Spiritual groups, more often than not, do not call themselves spiritual groups. Mostly only the ones that teach do. And the rest of them, they call themselves, you know, this society or that society, or this type of, you know, saving groups, or this type of helping groups. It's not necessary to use the word spiritual to be spiritual. As a matter of fact, sometimes it's mis- people who are doing not so much good because they want to feel better about themselves and say, well, we're spiritual. Yeah, but they may not be. Just because they say they are, they may not be anything. That's entirely possible. So it's really worthwhile to find and research the subject. Find people that want to help. If you want to give some assistance to us, hey, please do. By the way, in case you don't know, I'm going to be writing some more books, although some evil dudes are trying to prevent that from happening. But on these very matters that we're talking about. And if you want to assist with that in various ways, especially economically, you can. You can get together with a group of people who, you know, sponsor a book I'm going to write. And you can even tell me what you're interested in. And maybe we can collaborate and come together with that. Give us a call. I'm available. Email me. I know why life is. I mean, you know, there's lots of things that you can do to make a difference in the spiritual life of animals, including your pets. And those things may save the world. Because remember, this is what the world's depending upon. If we lose this battle, I think we may lose the planet. There won't be a next generation of human beings. So that's a pretty serious thing to think about. Now, what about pets? I want to finish with pets. If you have pets, treat them as well or better than your children. I know that's a tough one. Some people have so much belief that children are so important. I do believe children are important, by the way. But your pets are even more innocent, and they have less ability to adapt than your children. Even if you mistreat your children, they still, as they grow older, have ability to adapt and change and to throw away what you inculcated them. Pets are not so lucky. If you inculcate bad will and bad action in pets, if you make pets into the meanest demons and destructive creatures, if you beat them, if you starve them, if you don't love them, and I mean in real love terms, not because, well, you're cute and you give them a little pat on the butt. No, I'm talking about love in terms of enriching their life and growing their consciousness and working to make them a better living being. So that they become more loving, they become more conscious. That's what you need to do. Now that sounds like, well, wow, whatever, I can't put my pets before my children. You don't really have to put them before. You can treat them just as well in their own needs and own ways and still have children if you want to have children. And treat, most importantly, your children to respect and love pets in this way as a soul and a living being that has a spiritual life. And then the whole thing takes on a different nature. If you include your children in it, then the two are one, and now it's not an opposing issue. Now, what if you're poor and you can't really feed your pets and give it to someone who can? Don't keep pets because you just want to have them around and starve them. That's nuts. Or because you can't, if they get sick, you can't bring them to someone to help heal them, then you shouldn't have them. Only have pets you can take responsibility for in all the ways that they need your attention. Remember, that's your responsibility, not theirs. I hope this is coming, you know, for a lot of people, this may not make as much sense as other things I said in the show, but realize that your pets are not that different from us. They're more common than they are different. And also realize your pets will live an even greater life, sometimes longer, in the astral world after they die. So how they live and how they die is very important because it has an effect on their astral life. A And you want them to go to the higher astral subworlds where they will not only become a great enjoyment for those people that live there, but they will improve the group's souls so that the next round of that species of animal will be improved here in the physical world in the next generations of the animal. How long do pets live? It usually at least as long as they physically live in astral world time, sometimes two or three times longer. So it's a long time. I mean, a pet that lives 10 years here could live 30 years in the astral world, if it's in the higher subworlds and certain other issues. So that's a lot of time, believe me, if you think about it. So when we say, well, this dog's only going to live 8 or 9 years, so what's the big deal? No, that dog might live 20 years longer in the astral world. And they might even have a little bit of a few years of mental plane life, depending upon how advanced they are. You add it all together, it's a pretty long life. Many pets live as long or longer as their human counterparts lived while they were physically alive. And as you know, some parrots, elephants, not too many elephants are pets in this country, but you know, and certain other creatures can outlive human beings. They can live 70, 80, 90 years, possible, even though they may only average 60 or 70. But the point is, that comes out to a huge amount of astral time if they're really brought up in ways that are very loving and helpful and supportive. And all that astral time grows the development of the creative imagination part of all of that species of animals through the preconceptional thought and the astral thought of the pet soul. Wow. So there's a tremendous amount to be gained in this process, and we need to be, for those of you especially who are listening to me, to be critically aware that one of the things you can do the absolute most is to treat your animals with exceptional brilliance and help. Love your animals as much as possible and get them to be as loving as possible. Don't let them be unloving. If they are and you can't do anything with them, give them somebody else who will. Because remember, they are our future, not just for them. They're the future for the world. Loving them may be more important than loving your own children in terms of the future of the world. It's hard to understand, and for some people, they won't believe it. I might tell you not to love your children or anyone else's. I'm just saying you got to do it all. Too many people get lax about how they treat animals because they have so many problems in life, particularly in the physical world. They don't know they're mistreating the animals. They just don't care enough, and they don't love them enough to see it. I see it all the time. It breaks my heart. I absolutely cannot even witness it sometimes. It just tears me up inside. Somewhat because I know how it's destroying life in general, and somehow on the individual level, how terrible it is for that animal to suffer such things. Should we be killing? This is the last part of the show now. Should we be killing animals because there's too many of them? Absolutely not. I'd rather let them run feral and live as short a life as they're going to live than to go kill them. It makes absolutely no sense to be killing animals. I know we got too many. I know they're breeding like rats all over the place. But the point is, that's our own fault. And we have to take responsibility for that. The euthanization of animals that aren't on the verge of dying almost immediately is totally, absolutely criminal. It's murder in every other sense of the name. And it's done for the convenience of us, let's face it. You need to stop, be against it, do everything to stop it that you can. That's my last word for tonight. Because if you don't, it's all of us that will be euthanized by the spirit of life. Until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.
and rumors. Who's our next enemy? You got what we want. Ooh, you better give it to me. If you resist, ooh, you're a terrorist, see. I'll take everything you got, my way of setting you free. They quell objectioners, they kill the messengers. They quell objectioners, they kill the messengers up against the wall. And they call this living, living on earth. 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 The rich get richer, making more war. Richer and richer, making more poor. An eye for an eye, but turn the other cheek. As long as nothing interferes, nothing better stop the 40-hour week. Lies and misdirection are all that's said.
Lies and misdirection are all this.
Lies and misdirection are all your bed.
Lies and misdirection,
they work you till you're dead. And they call this living, living